WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
Hey, Chicago, it's Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a breakdown of the latest local news of the day. But first, President Trump has capped the number of refugees who can enter the country at 7,500 people. That is the lowest since the program began back in 1980. Now, he's also prioritizing the admission of white South Africans, or Afrikaners. So how is this impacting local refugee families? Well, we heard from a local refugee and an advocate. But first, here's In the Loop producer Linnea Dominic. She joins me now. Linnea put this all together. Hey, Linnea, good to see you.
You too, Sasha.
As always. So I love the fact that we're pivoting to this refugee resettlement conversation today because, as you know, we've been talking a lot about the intense immigration enforcement that we've seen spill out across the Chicago region. So this story just slipped under our radar, I think.
Yeah, there's so much to cover, and the immigration enforcement has been very brutal. So it makes sense in a certain way.
Yeah. However,
there are tens of millions of people worldwide who are seeking refugee status. So the Trump administration capping the admission of refugees at 7,500 is extremely significant and is just another way that he is really trying to shape who can be in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sow fear in communities.
Yeah. And I hate that lately I've just, as the host of this show, just felt like the bearer of bad news just over and over again. We've talked about this several times off the air, Linnea, and it's just on top of everything, right? The immigration enforcement, ICE, the government shutdown involving SNAP benefits now, that's impacted. All of these things sort of cascade on top of each other, and they're also impacting this very vulnerable population we're talking about today.
Yes, the big, beautiful bill that passed in the summer cut the ability for refugees, they're no longer able to receive SNAP benefits.
Wow.
So on top of everything, their ability to continue feeding themselves is in peril.
All the more reason for us to get to this conversation, Linnea. Thank you so much for stopping by.
My pleasure.
At the table, Sally Schulze, who's a communications manager for Refugee One. She started off the conversation by explaining how the legal designations and protections for refugees differ from immigrants and asylum seekers.
Yeah, I think people get confused by this. First of all, refugees are people that have been forced to flee their homes. They don't want to because of persecution, violence, the threat of persecution. They have to leave for their safety. And then they get protections before they get to the United States. I will tell you, this is not an easy process. It is not a quick process. It takes years. Some people are in refugee camps waiting for 20 years. When they get to the United States, they are legal permanent residents. They then can have a right to live in the state. They have a right to work here, and they get public benefits and the support that an organization like Refugee One can provide. Asylum seekers, which you mentioned, that is different. They try to get those protections once they get here.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, until they get approved, they have no public benefits, and that process often takes years.
Yes. So when you hear that the lowest numbers are going to be admitted here, like since the beginning, this program's been around for 40 plus years, What do you make of that?
It is devastating on several levels. First of all, I think of the tens of thousands of refugees who had been conditionally approved to be resettled here in the United States. We've abandoned them. They have no home to go back to. Here in Chicago, I have colleagues at Refugee One, and we have many clients as well who are separated from their families. And any hope that they had of a reunion anytime soon, mm-hmm. that vanished when this decision came out. I also think that we lose our standing as a humanitarian leader on the global stage with this decision.
Yeah, the process for vetting and applying to become a refugee, I don't think we can underscore that more, Sally. It takes years.
And it is so complete and rigorous. You are talking about security screenings, biometric screenings, medical screenings, in-person interviews, background checks. It goes on for years and years. So when people say, oh, we don't know who these people are coming to our country, that is not true. We know very well who they are.
We know everything about them.
Yes, we do indeed.
Everything possible. So we talked with Mohammed, who is using a pseudonym to protect his family. Mohammed is a refugee who works at Refugee One. His application process, it took 12 years. Here he is describing the rounds of interviews and screenings that he had to go through.
It is really overwhelming and stressful. You have to share your story all over with the strangers, not with the same person, with the new person. After the interview, they don't give you any sign of hope. They don't tell you you're selected or not. They'll just tell you, okay, we will call you. And the next call might take years to ring.
Yeah, the phone may take years to ring. Yeah. So I wonder about just the length of the process and whether there's been work over the years to, I mean, now we're at a different extreme and a totally new problem where they're saying we're going to limit the number of people we're letting into the country. But like, had there been work over time, Sally, to try to simplify that process?
You know, part of the issue is that the number of people needing help keeps going up. Right now, we have a historic high level of refugees. The UN estimates, or they know, it's about more than 42 million people are considered refugees. Fewer than 1% of them get resettled in a place like the United States. So it's a very small number that even get through this long process.
What are they looking for?
You know, that's a great question. And it's also, I think, going to be changing. And that's going to be a concern that we have going forward. But they want to make sure that these are people that, yes, we want in our country, but also they are going for the most vulnerable, those that are most at risk. All of these refugees have horrible stories. The ones who do get through the pipeline generally are, you know, they've gone through some of the worst and they have no safe place in which to live. They mm-hmm. need a new place in order to survive.
Tell us about some of those stories, because I know you've heard the worst of the worst. What are the conditions that people are trying to escape in their home countries?
I mean, honestly, they've gone through hell. I think right now of Sudan and South Sudan, where the violence just keeps escalating. It's considered the worst humanitarian crisis happening right now, where there's such violence, there's mass rape. People can't get the basics you need, food, water, shelter, let alone an education or even a hope of having a future. And when I think about what's happening there in Sudan, I think of a young Sudanese woman that I met through Refugee One, mm-hmm. who we resettled her and her family when she was 7 years old. She's now a freshman in college, and she got a full scholarship to a great college because she just killed it in high school, giving so much to her community and the people around her. And she knows what an opportunity she got to come here. So now she wants to be a doctor so she can give back. So I think of her and I think of that next 7-year-old in Sudan or South Sudan. Are we going to help that little girl reach their potential, or are we going to turn our backs on that? And I think we all know what the answer to that question should be, because historically in the U.S., we have been there to help. Right now, we are turning our backs on that.
Yeah, imagine she hadn't come here at 7 years old, right?
Right.
What a different life she might have had. So Mohammed, who we just heard from, Mohammed found out in 2017 that he was cleared to come to the U.S. That was during President Trump's travel ban. Remember that, Sally?
Oh, yes.
He wasn't able to enter at the time. And now when the ban was lifted years later, Mohammed was told that he could enter. But at the time, his life had changed.
Last time I was single, but now I'm a whole package. I created my life. I have my family. I have my wife. I have my kids. They were like, no, you will have to redo the whole process. Me and my wife, we had to say, okay, what are our options? And we had two options. One was, okay, reverse everything and do everything all over. or I may continue my journey, come to the U.S. and apply for a family reunification process. So I picked the second choice. We picked the second choice. And then once I came to the United States, I started working on that. I applied, I filed for my family. I didn't thought that this will come. I will be stopped again or I will be impacted again. But unfortunately, this is the sad reality that we're living today.
You know, and what I'm hearing too, Sally, is, I mean, he's going through the process. He's complying, doing every step as he's supposed to, right? And still.
That is so important. And again, all the refugees right now who've been conditionally approved to come here, they followed the rules. They followed the law. They did what they were told. This is a legal pathway that we had given them. And now we're just, you know, stealing that away. And as you hear Mohammed's story, he made a really tough choice to come here because there is a reunification process and really thought that that would work. And he'd be able to bring his five children and his wife here with him shortly after him. He now has no idea when that will be possible. And he says he cannot even envision a future for him and his family. And his children need him. He needs his children.
That is a long time to be separated from five kids.
Yes. And, you know, little kids, like it's a lifetime to see them, how they change in just a few months. And he's missing that.
Here's a bit more from Mohammed. This is him describing how he felt. This is when he found out President Trump had capped the number of refugees.
We're really disappointed. Is a pain because it separates me from my family. I can't see my kids. My kids can't see me. My children's voices are starting to become memories instead of real sounds. I can't really describe, I don't have the exact words of that pain, but it's really hard not being able to rejoin or reunite with your family. That's really hard, and it shouldn't happen to human beings.
Shouldn't happen to human beings, right? He says. Do you know what? Despite all of this, Mohammed says that he has not fully lost hope. Can you believe that?
He told me that he grew up, because he hasn't had a home since he was a child. He's been a refugee for a long time until he came here to Chicago. And he tells me that he had this dream of America, and he's passed that on to his kids, and he believes in that. He still has hope that, yes, one day his kids will get to be here with him and live the American dream, as he calls it.
Mm-hmm. Here's the other part to this that I teased earlier, Sally. Not only is the number of refugees capped, the Trump administration is prioritizing white South Africans or Afrikaners. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I'm not here to analyze whether or not a Afrikaner has a credible claim to persecution, but I can tell you they have been fast-tracked. They have cut to the front of the line, and to us, that does not seem fair. Again, tens of thousands of refugees have already gone through rigorous vetting in years. They've waited for years in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. We would like to see the administration prioritize these people who desperately need a home.
Even the South African government is speaking out against this.
Yeah. And I can tell you that, you know, resettling South Afrikaners, that's not going to be our priority. Our focus continues to be at Refugee One. We have thousands of refugees here in Chicago already that continue to need our help. We're focusing on them. We're also looking to see what the number will be for people with SIVs. That's a special immigrant visa. Mm-hmm. These are our Afghan allies who fought with U.S. forces, who worked with U.S. forces in the Afghanistan war. We have been able to resettle about 45 of them since Inauguration Day, and we're looking forward to seeing what the number of will be allowed in this next fiscal year, because this is an important group that we can aid right now.
As you said, you're focused on some of these other groups. Here's what the Trump administration says. They say, quote, other victims of illegal or unjust discrimination in their respective homelands will be admitted. Do you have any reason, though, to believe that some of the people that you serve could be admitted under this descriptor? It's very specific descriptor.
Yeah, it's specific, but it's still hard to tell what that is going to mean. As you know, Sasha Ann, in the last 9 months, is it now? It's hard to keep track, right? It's hard to know what the federal government is going to do. So we will be prepared to see what does come down the pike. And in the meantime, we keep focusing on those refugees here in Chicago that we can help with getting new jobs, learning English, helping their kids in school and getting adjusted, and working through their trauma because they've already gone through trauma just to get here. And now with the hostility towards immigrants, we are seeing that need increase.
Yeah, tell me more about that. How are your clients at Refugee One handling all of the uncertainty? There's been so many, many moves made, lots that were vague, with, to your point, that left us with more questions than answers. How are they feeling about that? And because this is all impacting their ability to reunite with their families at the end of the day.
Yes, it is that, but also just to live their life on a daily basis. Right. We are seeing an environment of fear. Again, they are here as legal permanent residents. Many have green cards, some have citizenship, but still, as we've seen, the color of their skin or the accent that they have can make them a target. So some are worried about leaving their house. Some are worried about their kids going to school. Some are worried about being targeted. And keep in mind that a lot of these people came from persecution. Some of them lived under authoritarian regimes. We are now seeing a lot of things that seem like PTSD because they are having flashbacks of where they came from. And it is very unexpected. We are trying to support them the best we can. Our mental health team, we're very lucky to have therapists who can work with them at many different levels to support the whole family because that is increasingly important right now.
So there's an even bigger toll here to the wait.
Oh, completely. Yes.
It's not just the passage of time.
No. And these are people, again, they have gone through so much and they came here for a fresh start. And I got to tell you, the gratitude that you see as they get here and they are ready for this fresh start, the joy that they bring, the resilience is astounding and inspiring every day. But then to see them have to hear the environment in which we live right now, it is very difficult. And we are thankful for our community, our staff at Refugee One, as well as our network of, we have hundreds of volunteers and community groups we work with and faith groups we work with who all are there to support the refugees here in Chicago and also to tell anybody that will listen, we see the benefit of when we bring these people into our communities. Right. We are all made better for it.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear from Mohammed once more. Here's a little bit on that American dream you talked about earlier, Sally. This is his message to listeners.
I just want to tell the world to see us and view us as people, as humans equal to them. We are fathers, mothers, and children who love each other. And all we are asking for is a chance to be together, to be safe, and build a peaceful life in this beautiful country.
A final message from you, Sally, and what you're going to keep an eye on.
You know, I think what stands out to me as I've gotten to know so many refugees is not what makes us different, but it is what we have in common. And it is like they want their kids to go to school in a good school. They want to be able to put dinner on the table. They want to live in a safe place, just like the rest of us. And again, when you get to know these refugees, when we bring them into our communities, yes, it boosts our economy, but it enriches us all in a multitude of ways, and it can expand your world. And I think if you're doing it right, it can expand your heart as well.
Sally Schulze is Communications Manager with Refugee One. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having this important conversation.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Invisible Wounds Foundation, committed to healing military members living with brain injuries suffered in service. Thousands of service members are living with traumatic and devastating brain injuries that we can't see. Join the mission by texting DUTY to 53555 to give, or learn more at invisiblewounds.org. WBEZ's nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Okay, now it's time to catch you up on the biggest stories of the day. We checked in with WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane, Sun-Times health reporter Elvia Malagon, and Sun-Times reporter and editor Mitch Armentrout. Elvia, I want to start with the latest on SNAP benefits, what's more widely known, of course, as food stamps. Yesterday, the White House said it will pay only half of what was expected for November. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So Illinois typically receives about $350 million per month. And so it's going to get about half of that. And the big question that remains is, when will people actually receive that money? And the state did not have a set date. They used the term days or weeks. Mm-hmm. And one expert that I spoke to said it's very or highly unlikely that it's going to happen this week.
Goodness. And we have to think about the fact, too, that a lot of folks are staggered as far as which day they actually receive their benefits, right? Not everybody receives it on the first. And so it's just creating sort of a backlog for each person.
That's correct.
Yeah. What are you hearing from Chicagoans that you've spoken with about this?
I think people are saying that, you know, one woman we spoke to, she's a SNAP recipient and she's been looking at the news every day to kind of see what the latest update is. People are concerned that all of this is confusing. Some people may not know if they're going to get their benefits or not. And I think in general, I mean, a lot of advocates say that even with the full amount, people were still running out of money. And especially mm-hmm. when it came to the end of the month, they were really looking forward to getting that money. And now it's kind of uncertain where yeah. that would come from. But as we wrote about in today's paper, there are a lot of people across Chicago that are really trying to do what they can. I don't think anyone could fill this big of a funding gap, but they really are trying to do what they can to provide meals and pantry staples for people.
Yeah. Well, Claire, smoking on the CTA. Yeah, we know that that is a problem. Riders at least do. Now we've got data to back this up. So what does it show us exactly?
Well, we know that there's smoke. The Chicago Transit Authority logged 14,000 smoking complaints in 14 months. Mm-hmm. So the Sun-Times FOIA'd the agency, and Sun-Times is reporting that those complaints were filed to the CTA by email as well as by a chatbot. That the agency installed between late April 2024, that was when the chatbot first launched, and late June of this year. So the bot essentially just lets users, riders, report issues in real time mm-hmm. and alert staff to complaints on board, smoking a very common complaint. And that data shows smoking complaints peaked during the evening commute. They also vary by line. So if you want to guess, you can. But what took the cake for most smoking complaints?
Yeah.
CTA Red Line. It's also the busiest line. It yes. also runs round the clock. Blue Line riders have filed nearly 3,500 smoking complaints, and then Green Line riders came in third. They filed nearly 1,800. So in response, just so far, this year, the CTA has said that Chicago police arrested 33 people, and they issued 107 citations for smoking. But
starting
if you're looking at the numbers,
seriously.
But 107 citations versus, you yeah. know, people who ride the Red Line filing 5,500 complaints, right? It's kind of a big discrepancy there. But the CTA and CPD would not tell the Sun-Times, did not provide information about how many arrests were made for smoking in 2023 and 2024. Mm. So more data, probably more questions going to come from this.
Well, it's just gross. Stop smoking on the buses and trains, people.
Yeah, I think I was on the Red Line for like all 10,000 of those. It feels like.
Did you? You were one that filed 5,000 complaints?
Yes. Those complaints were by you. Mitch, while you're in the hot seat, tell us what we're hearing from Governor Pritzker and other state and city leaders about SNAP benefits, as we were just talking about with Elvia.
Right. So I believe it was last month, Governor Pritzker issued an executive order that would direct about $20 million in state funds to help kind of cover the gap. But, you know, with the numbers that Elvia was sharing, I think that covers maybe a couple days of benefits.
Yeah.
So really just not even scratching the surface. I think all local leaders are acknowledging that they can't really do much until the federal government does something. But yeah, I mean, at the city level, we've seen aldermen in all different neighborhoods, you know, promoting food pantries. We've seen that all across the Chicago area. Over the weekend in Evanston, there was a huge food drive. We're still kind of obviously in the early stages here, and we'll see how things play out the next couple of weeks with, you know, maybe some trickle of benefits coming in at some point, but it's kind of touch and go.
It's taking a lot of us to sort of work together, band together to help in the meantime. Let's stay with Pritzker. He's expected to decide soon whether he's going to sign a bill that would make Illinois a so-called right-to-die state. Tell us about that legislation.
Right. So there's 11 other states that have done this. Oregon was the first about 20 years ago. And basically, for folks who have a terminal diagnosis, they would be allowed to be prescribed a drug that would end their lives. opponents, mainly from the Catholic Church, call this assisted suicide and vehemently oppose it. But there are a lot of proponents, including from the ACLU, who say that, you know, folks should have some say in how they exit this mortal plane. The Illinois legislature very narrowly passed this last week, kind of, literally in an overnight vote. Folks weren't really expecting this to come up for a vote. It passed the Illinois House several months ago.
So then how likely do you think it is that Pritzker will approve?
He says he's still thinking about it, but I think based on his comments yesterday, it sounds like he could potentially be leaning towards signing it, or at least not completely vetoing it. You know, he basically said that, you know, he's pretty deeply affected by, you know, just the plight of folks who find themselves in the situation. I mean, it's a situation that a lot of us have found ourselves in with a loved one, you know, with a terminal diagnosis.
Yes.
And it's obviously a hugely painful ordeal for everyone involved. And, you know, this is one way to potentially address that.
Claire, we continue to cover the Trump administration's aggressive immigration enforcement in the Chicago area. Now, our colleague Araceli Gomez-Aldana has been answering listener questions over the past several weeks. Here's a new one she got. The question is, what qualifications must applicants meet to be hired by ICE or Border Patrol? Sum that up for us.
Yeah, so apparently it depends on which federal agency we're talking about. So Immigration and Customs Enforcement and then Customs and Border Patrol have both been deployed here to Chicago, but their training is different. Their duties are also slightly different. So ICE often conducts arrests and deportations in the interior of the U.S., while CPB generally focuses on the country's borders, physical points of entry. ICE applicants must be at least 18 years old, go through drug and medical screenings, background checks, and have a complete knowledge and physical fitness test that they have to pass. CPB has a very similar screening process, but they're trained differently, right? Because these are the people that are physically at borders. They also have fewer legal constraints when operating within 100 miles of an international border. Araceli also interviewed a Homeland Security correspondent for NBC, who said that a lot of the people on the ground in Chicago are part of Border Patrol. And oftentimes they are the ones that are using these more aggressive tactics. They're the ones who have been called to court over this, what you're talking about a little bit later in the program. They're also the ones who have used tear gas more readily.
Absolutely.
And again, if people want to submit a question to Araceli, they can do that at wbez.org/guard.
Governor Pritzker says the state's new accountability commission is gathering evidence of possible misconduct by these federal agents. So the governor says Border Patrol agents don't have the proper training to work in Chicago. And he says they need to, quote, go away. Now, Elvia, I'm looking at you because before covering health for the Sun-Times, you covered immigration, right? And I'm curious of your thoughts of this ongoing saga that we've been seeing, the arrests, the raids, just the aggression.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's something totally different than what even the first Trump administration was. We didn't see this level of tactics, especially when it came to detaining people. I mean, one of the big issues beforehand was collateral arrest, right? And not just going over a specific person who, quote unquote, had like a criminal background, but they would arrest people all around. But now it's just seems like it's so completely, it seems like most of the arrests are collateral arrests. And it's just a completely different landscape than what it was years ago.
And speaking of immigration, Claire, a town hall meeting about the Broadview ICE processing facility got cut short last night. What happened?
So these are regular monthly meetings that, you know, various suburbs have with their village board. So Broadview Mayor Katrina Thompson ended last night's meeting because of there was lots of shouting about her handling over the Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in her suburb. Sun-Times reports that protesters spoke out during the public commenting portion of the meeting, you know, just yelling, accusing Thompson of failing to protect their free speech. She had, you know, issued a couple of restrictions. She wanted protest hours to be more specific outside of the facility. She also had an aid tent removed, which they said, again, sort of violated their First Amendment rights. Broadview's public works director, who was there, defended Thompson, defended Broadview PD, and called some protesters agitators. This was all at the meeting last night. And after public comment ended, Thompson did address some people's concerns. I mean, she's been very outspoken against federal immigration agents in the past, calling their tactics, agreeing with a lot of these protesters, saying that they are aggressive and they're dangerous to residents and people. But, you know, she's also had to put some boundaries in place, but really didn't want to get into it. It seemed last night.
I feel it for Mayor Thompson. That's tough.
She's working.
Yeah, stay tuned. In less than 10 minutes, we're doing a deep dive into what conditions are like inside that Broadview facility. It was built as a short-term processing center, but it's been used for days-long detentions. So we're going to hear from the legal director of the ACLU of Illinois about a new lawsuit that's aimed at improving the conditions inside. There's even a hearing happening right now. So we're going to find out what the federal government is also saying back. Claire, let me stick with you here. Just tell us what else you're watching.
Just something Sarah Karp has been actively pursuing, one of our reporters, Chicago Board of Education, considering today proposals about how to handle the planned closure. This is of two privately run schools. So if approved, Chicago High School for the Arts would stay open as a district-run magnet school. But the future of its arts conservatory remains sort of in question. Also, Epic Charter School would be allowed to close. Teachers and students would like to stay together in a new school, they've told Sarah, but the board is still seeing if there's even a way at this point to make that happen. So certainly more to come on that during Morning Edition tomorrow.
All right. Well, Mitch, every day, it seems like we're one day closer to Illinois' primary election happening on March 17th. You're smiling because this is also in the background. You've also got to focus on this. But a high-profile congressman is not going to be seeking re-election. Breaking news.
Jesus Chuy Garcia. He's been a progressive stalwart in the Chicago area for, four decades or so. Former alderman, Cook County commissioner, state senator, and the 4th District congressman for the last 6 years, roughly, I think, by the end of his term.
Wow.
Yesterday was the candidate filing deadline. Folks who want to be on the ballot for next year's primary had to turn in their signatures. Chuy turned in his about a week ago, but kind of heads started scratching in the political world at 5 o'clock last night when his chief of staff, Patty Garcia, submitted petitions. And our colleague, Tina Svondelis, was the first to report that Chuy will indeed be stepping down at the end of his term next year. And this is kind of a classic old school Chicago political move as far as a longtime incumbent pulling his papers at the last second after his preferred successor, presumed preferred successor, files their papers. Had he announced he was retiring 6 months ago, you would have seen a huge field of candidates vying for that seat, like we're seeing in several other congressional races Chicago.
So who could be in his seat next?
Well, right now there's only three people who have filed, including Chuy's chief of staff, who seems to be the anointed one. There's also a Republican and an independent candidate who, you know, this is a deep blue district. They face an uphill battle either way. Chuy certainly helped clear the path for his, a close associate here.
Mm-hmm. End of an era, that'll be for sure. Now, Elvia, as we wait to see what's going to happen with SNAP benefits, because as you said earlier, we're still in limbo, right? Still not sure when folks will start to get money into their accounts. What is happening in the meantime with WIC? That's the Women, Infants, and Children's program that provides assistance to pregnant women and babies and new moms.
That program seems to be okay. And actually, the Trump administration did a funding boost of $450 million for that specific program, as SNAP is essentially in limbo. So it seems like that program will be okay for however long the shutdown goes on. But as advocates have told me, that program it's a food assistance program, but it's much more limited. It's really for, you know, pregnant women, young mothers, really small children, where SNAP is really available to, for example, the elderly, people living with disabilities, households with children. So it's a much more broad sector of the population.
That's right. You talk about, however long the shutdown goes on. We're at day 35 of this federal government shutdown, folks. And this means that we've tied the record, actually, for the longest shutdown ever, which also happened under President Trump's watch, if you remember, back in 2018, 2019. What is the latest, Elvia, on that rising price of Affordable Care Act subsidies piece of things?
That still seems to be one of the things that really is at the heart of this fight between Democrats and Republicans, and really for people who are here living in the state and rely on the ACA for their health coverage. Open enrollment started November 1st. So
That you could potentially have double, triple the premiums for your health insurance?
Yeah.
When you already could barely afford it?
Yeah. So people have already kind of started to see those increases.
Wow.
I would say one good thing about people who live here is that the state separate from all of this, they had already planned to do their own marketplace. And actually, the state is investing a little bit of money into these so-called navigators. So if you go on their website, put in your zip code, you could find a community group that could help you navigate, figure out, okay, which plan should I choose, mm-hmm. which might be best for my needs and that I could actually afford.
Leave us with this, Mitch. What stories do you have your eye on?
I'll be excited to see more of the political reaction to Chewy stepping down. You know, obviously, like I said, this is kind of an unpopular political maneuver, but undeniably, just a figurehead of Chicago politics for so long. I think we're going to see a lot of remittances for what he's contributed.
Yeah. Elvia Melagon and Mitch Armantrout of the Sun-Times, also WBEZ's Claire Lane.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Linnea Dominic, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.
Rise and shy. WBEZ is serving local stories for breakfast every weekday morning from 5 to 11. Tune in on the WBEZ app to hear what Chicago's talking about as you start your day.